Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, everybody, we got a great one today. You know, for a change. And I can guarantee that this is actually a great one and not one of our usual stinkers, because it's a best of. And during Christmas time and New Year's, Peter and I take a break here at the podcast and run a couple of best ofs for you. And this one is maybe the best of the best of. And this time, I mean that, because it's my conversation with Jim Gaffigan, who for my money is one of the great stand-ups of our era. And Jim is sort of notorious for being a clean act that the whole family can go to and love. He's not political. He doesn't do political stuff. So he attracts audiences in very red areas of the country and very blue areas without working blue or red. But in 2020, he just had to speak out about Donald Trump, and we talk about that. He may have lost some fans, but it didn't hurt him at all. He's got a monster tour coming up this winter and spring that includes, of course, New York City and Portland, Oregon, but also Pensacola, Florida, and Sugar Land, Texas, and, Thackersville, Oklahoma. I don't know where that is. But Jim Gaffigan is loved all over this country, and if you haven't heard this conversation, I know you'll love him too. So we'll be back with some new shows in January. But for now, my conversation with Jim Gaffigan, another great one, you know, for a change. The best way to learn a language, immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
I like to say, we always say, this podcast is like The Daily without the resources of The New York Times.
It's very similar. Now, when do you listen to that? You wake up and you turn it on?
No, I do it randomly. I'm a random person.
Yeah.
I don't have good habits.
I also think in New York City, unless you have like a commute on the subway, it's like, when do you listen to a podcast? Whereas people, you know, the drive, I can totally get it.
Yeah. And actually when the pandemic hit,
yeah,
podcast took a big hit because.
Oh.
Yeah. Because
that would make sense.
Yeah. Some things make sense.
Yeah.
But you, as a comedian, like to explore things that don't seem to make sense.
It's called a point of view.
I really love your stuff.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I think because you're prolific, so prolific, what special is this for Netflix? How many?
This will be my 9th hour special.
Okay. Holy shit.
Well, you know, yeah, I didn't, but you know, comedy is all, what people don't realize, it's all self-assignment. Do you know what I mean? Like, there are very talented people that could, you know, have 9 specials, but it's self-assignment, and I also feel like, you know, there's nothing more rewarding than coming up with a new bit, right?
Yep, yep. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about your, dare I say, process.
My process.
What's your process?
I call it a process.
Oh, that's much better. Okay. What's, I mean, we've talked a little bit about that. One of the things we talked about is that your wife has at times written with you.
Yes.
And when I read that, I got so mad at my wife. Because I felt like, honey, why don't you write like Jim Gaffigan's wife writes?
Well, it is interesting because like some of why I started giving credit is obviously, you know, it was the truth. But also I feel as though
in some ways,
I feel like these partners, these life partners have been a sounding board for so many people. I mean, you know, particularly comedians that stand-ups that are just trying out bits before they leave their apartment or home. You know, if you're not in a writer's room, you know, if you're coming up with an idea, you're bouncing it off the person in the room. And if you're with someone, you're going to do it.
Do you ever get mad at your wife for not?
I've never been angry at my wife once. Yeah. No, it's
such an evolution because. You know, we have 5 kids, and before we had children, the collaboration was at a different level. I would do a show. She would come with me to shows.
Sure.
And then we would discuss it over a glass of wine. And then maybe when we had 1 or 2 kids, we would put the kids to sleep. And now we have teenagers. So, like, there's just, it's like living in Grand Central.
So you have 5 kids.
Yeah.
Okay. Gaffigan. What's your wife's maiden name?
Noth. She's 1 of 9. So it's kind of Alsace-Lorraine German or whatever.
Oh, yeah. My dad's side is Alsace.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And her grandfather wrote a book called Berlin Tenement, and he escaped with my wife's grandmother, who was Jewish, and they... these Dominican priests helped her escape, and they hid her. They said she was like their cleaning lady. And my wife's grandfather was kind of like a character, and he would show up, and then suddenly this woman that lived with priests got pregnant. But anyway, so they saved her life, so she converted.
Where was this? Where were these Dominican priests?
In France somewhere. And so my father-in-law's name is Dominic because of the Dominican nuns that saved
her. And Dominic, that's a Catholic order.
Catholic order.
And what are the Dominicans like? I know the Jesuits. I like the Jesuits.
Yeah. I don't know. I should know. I mean,
are you Catholic?
Like, I am, but you know, I'm not like Colbert Catholic. Colbert like knows like the history, and you know, he could go toe to toe with any, you know, St. Thomas More and all this. But like, I know some of it. There's a lot to know, and I'm lazy.
I outdate you in my religion, and I know not very much.
It is weird. It's weird when you have a religion or just even a cultural association with a religion that people assume you would know all these things. Like, you're like, well, I don't know that. You know what I mean?
I thought that you would know what.
I know that when my wife was in the hospital, I was praying. You know what I mean? That's what I know.
Yeah. Okay. So the process with your wife, so it changed. It changed. It changed.
It's ever evolving. That's not to say that her fingerprints are not on everything and on certain projects. I mean, I should also say my wife is my acting coach. You know, when I was on Broadway, she was instrumental in preparing me for that.
God, now I got something else to be mad at Franny about.
And also, what I wrote two books, but your books are great. My books are okay. And she transformed, like, I would write paragraphs and she would be like, you know, this is supposed to be an essay. And I'm like, can you fix it? So she's much more, because her father was worked for a newspaper and as a writer. So she.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Can much more.
There you go.
Do the essay.
As we say in Minnesota. There you go.
There you go.
Yeah. And she's Milwaukee, you say?
Yes, she's Milwaukee.
And you're near Gary.
I'm near Gary in Indiana.
Yeah. So.
Which is kind of, it's Chicagoland, but Chicago doesn't admit to it. And also Indiana doesn't admit to it.
So you're close to Gary. You were close to Gary?
Yeah, very close
like
to Gary.
Like a suburb of Gary?
Yeah. I mean, they'd given up on suburbs of Gary Gary was like the first white flight area, I suppose. In 1937, Gary was Time Magazine's most beautiful city in the world.
Really?
Yes. And it's...
That's just shocking.
Yeah. So, like, it was like there was a time...
Wait, in the what? In the world?
In the world. It was fine. Yeah. And...
Rome? No.
No, I know. Well, maybe I'm probably getting something wrong. But it's also an American magazine. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. It was an American magazine in 1937. You know what I mean?
Yes. Okay. We're jingoistic in 37.
Yeah. There was a little, you know, they were still kind of like, you know.
But we, in 1937, a lot of Americans really liked Germany.
Well, I think in like at the start of World War I or World War II, might have been World War I. More Americans spoke German than English. Did you know that?
No.
I read that.
I think that's wrong.
I don't know. We should have someone find that. No, I'm serious. There's an enormous... It's so weird because, like, I travel all around America because I'm a great American. No, but, like, there is...
You do travel all the... Now, how many gigs do you do a year? How many shows do you do a year?
I say I'll do three. I probably perform 300 nights a year.
Really?
But, you know, sometimes that's in New York City at Gotham Comedy Club. That's, you know, and that's part of the writing process. I'm sure, you know the feeling. You're up there and you're like, you know what, this thing works. You know, we did a spot together. And
at Gotham.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's what's so great about stand-up is it is this conversation with the audience. And so the feedback you get from the audience will
tell you where
to go.
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing a tour. It's just a 15-city tour, so I'm a piker. But I can feel myself getting stronger, and I go down to the Comedy Cellar.
Yeah.
But I like Gotham a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a nice club.
Yeah, I mean, Christmas Illy just, it's so funny because you want to hear something really funny. So Christmas Illy, this is not funny, don't worry. Christmas Illy, I've known him forever, and he worked at a comedy club, and he wanted to start a comedy club that was clean, meaning like, you know, his family had a grocery store, and I think on Long Island, and he was like, I want to open a comedy club where someone's girlfriend or wife can go to the bathroom and it's not disgusting. That shows you how long.
Oh, clean, like actually, like hygienic.
But one of the, he told me this, that one of the people that used to do stand up when I started was Brian Kilmeade of Fox News, Fox and Friends.
Yeah, horrible, horrible.
Isn't that amazing? Person. You know, like the intersection of entertainment news is pretty. The overlap's pretty consistent.
I think this is a story you might... Do you ever watch like MSNBC and CNN and stuff?
Okay. Yeah.
So I watch a lot, and my wife watches a lot. So I went to the premiere of Veep, the last season of Veep, at like, I can't remember, it was Avery Fisher Hall or something. And there was a party afterwards, and I stayed kind of late. Ari Melber is there.
Yeah.
And so we said, I like him and yeah. talking. He goes like, have you noticed that I do a lot of bad jokes on my show? But I recognize, you know, that they're bad jokes. And I said, uh-huh. Or you could do good jokes. And that's how I feel.
Like, I have this theory that all newscasters or all political newscasters, like Brian Williams is very funny.
He's very funny.
Brian Williams is very funny. Keith Olbermann, huge comedy fan.
And funny.
Like a total comedy nerd.
Yeah.
And then like Ari's, but it's also, it's comedy and music. Like Ari's really into music.
Yeah, he's introduced the MSNBC audience to a lot of hip hop.
But it is fascinating how much they want to do the comedy. They want, like, Rachel wants to be funny all the time.
Yeah, she's joking all the time.
It's so interesting. Like, even when you meet musicians that want to be funny, I'm like, to me, I look at music as magic. Like, you know, like the Foo Fighters, what they do is like magic to me. Adele is magic. You know, Jay-Z, it's like, how do you do that?
Of course.
And they're like, they want to be comedians, which is weird. Like, even like I did this benefit show and Bruce Springsteen was there and he told all these jokes. Do you know what I mean? And they were really filthy. I mean, I enjoyed it because it's kind of like, it's just strange to see someone, and you know he's.
Wait, this was on stage. You were telling
this
the jokes?
This was on stage, and it was really charming in an interesting way because it wasn't. They weren't inappropriate. You know what I mean? They were just kind of.
Well, you were talking about your friend who wanted to open a clean club.
Yeah,
but I thought you meant clean, like that the comics worked clean. Did you mean that too?
No.
Okay. No.
Well, that
just
being said,
a club where someone could go to the men's room
was something that was definitely missing from. I mean, Caroline's also was very high end. I guess. Yeah, I should have said high end.
Okay. You know,
or a nice place, but now that's the standard in most comedy clubs.
Yeah, I do the Comedy Cellar a lot, and it's perfectly. Find the bathroom.
Yeah. But it used to be dangerous. You know, not dangerous, but like.
The other day there, this was for the first time that I went to the bathroom there, they had a guy hand you a towel.
Yeah, you don't need that.
Did you ever see Kevin Nealon's piece where he is that guy, but it's Harvey Keitel? You know, he folds the paper for him. I mean, it's. he gets a newspaper for him.
Yeah.
It's Kevin's. Kevin did Attitude,
yeah.
right? Now,
yeah.
you watched SNL.
Yeah.
Didn't you, like, look at Kevin and go, he's brilliant. He does Attitude.
Yeah. And there's something about, I mean, he has a cadence and a dry. I mean, I like dry. You're dry.
Mm-hmm.
If you like dry, he's dry, you know?
Well, what are you? Are you?
I think I'm dry. Hopefully,
yeah, I think you are, but you get wet laughs. I mean, people are laughing the whole time.
Yeah,
I think that you sometimes are underestimated, just in terms of the pantheon of the great comedians working now. And you'll hear Chappelle, and who's great, and there's a lot of great comedians, but because. I think it's partly because you work clean.
Yeah.
By the way, when you said a clean place, I thought you were referring to how dirty some of these acts. At the Comedy Cellar, I was just shocked because I hadn't done clubs in forever.
Yeah.
And how dirt filthy it is. And at a certain point, I was just going, this is ridiculous. You can't. And then I started going like, oh, there's some really good filthy comics.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when I perform the Comedy Cellar, these comics are so dirty that about half to three quarters of the time, I can start my act by saying, you know, Brian killed, but no wonder he stole my act.
Right, right.
And it's just following someone who's so filthy.
Right.
And But it curls your hair. But then you start to listen, and there's a difference.
Oh, yeah. No, and there is a nuance. You know, and when we say, like, filth, we're not talking about curse words or taboo topics. We're talking about, like, the raw guts of humanity and, like, stuff that, like, husbands and wives don't talk about. You know what I mean? But, like, some of that is – people love that. People love that honesty. But, you know, I'm kind of an old school guy in that I think that I love filthy humor. I love, you know, and I think some comedians, it's totally, you know, you got to be authentic. So it's like, I wouldn't want Chris Rock or Lewis Black to not curse. You know what I mean? That would be wrong. But I do think it's like, you got to fit your persona. So
there's,
like,
a difference between cursing and some of the stuff.
Yeah.
Which involves
yeah.
a lot of very graphic stuff.
But I think, like, shock and irreverence is like liberty. Like, the concept is just always being pushed. And the problem with it always being pushed is that things that were shocking 10 years ago are not shocking and possibly just poor taste. Whereas, if, do you know what I mean? It's like Bill Hicks is an amazing comedian. But if we watched it, we would be, like, blown away by the level of homophobia, the hatred behind some of it, and the absence of nuance. And that's just about irreverence moving. And so, like, I think that some of that irreverence, I mean, you know, I've got teenagers. You know, my 15-year-old son loves shock. He loves it. And when we were that age, we did too.
When did you start doing comedy? When did you start doing
1801. No, 1990.
And how old were you in 1990?
I think I was maybe 22, 24.
You really should know when you were
I should. Born. Yeah, I do know. All right, so yeah, so I was 24.
Okay.
Yeah, I should know when I was born.
You weren't doing comedy, like, in school?
No. I was raised... I'm the youngest of six kids. My father was the first one to go to college in the family. Success was wearing a coat and tie. It took my family generations to get to the middle class. And so it was like the idea of going into entertainment was not, I didn't know anyone in the entertainment industry. Did you?
No. Well, actually, not until I started going to a place called the Brave New Workshop in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
You know, Minneapolis is a really good
comedy town. Yeah, it's very creative. Yeah.
And you just did your
tape, my special there.
Your special there at the State Theater. And they're a great audience.
Yeah, amazing. And there's a great comedy club today right now in Minneapolis called Acme. Acme. One of the best in the country.
Yep. So, like, okay, but you were funny, like, to your friends.
Yeah.
So how quickly did your approach to comedy develop when you start at 24? For example, you and I have discussed this, the voice that you have, the critic of your stuff, which is, to me, a get-out-of-jail-free card all the time.
It helps a lot.
Tell me, just do that voice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really weird. I think Franken and Jim Gaffigan sound similar.
But yeah, no, so that... That inside voice is, it's an incredible tool, and it's something that I had as a teenager that I would use to diffuse situations when I would be late or I would say something awkward, and it's just kind of giving voice to somebody, to a different opinion or someone that I'm communicating with. Like, I can't believe Jim's late. Jim was late for the podcast. I mean, I thought he was more buttoned up. That's just kind of hostile to be late. Do you know what I mean? I just feel like, you know what I mean?
So you're doing that in high school.
Yeah.
With friends or with...
With friends or, and you know, and I remember in middle school doing it a little bit. It was just giving a voice to someone else and also my insecurities. You know what I mean? Kind of to diffuse this situation.
But very often it is that guy reacting to... It's usually when you've, it seems to me, it's when you've really gone in one direction, invested in it, and then you just undercut it.
Yeah, it gives an opportunity for a different point of view on a topic. So if I'm talking about bacon or horses, the inside voice can articulate the fatigue that the audience might feel. Also, the an opposing view that they might have.
Yeah.
It's probably more useful today because there is a certain amount of outrage that exists now, right? People feel a possessiveness or a defensiveness on things. So it's probably important for them to feel heard.
Yeah, so you have it both ways.
Yeah.
Which is great.
It keeps it fresh. And it's usually, something I completely improvise in the shows.
Uh-huh.
And then if it really works, then I save it and use it later. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So surrounding a bit. And, particularly if you're trying out a bit and you're not clear, because people don't realize sometimes you have this formulated idea that you're like, this is magic. And then you do it and the audience stares at you because you haven't communicated it properly. So,
can you think of your latest example of that?
Well, I'm working on this joke where I talk about my wife has a things that shouldn't be funny but end up being funny. Like my wife has a swallowing disorder, and the audience is like, that's not funny. Don't talk about that. You know what I mean? And she has a swallowing disorder because she had a brain tumor.
Right.
All right, red flag number two. Let's just move on.
Although you're hilarious about the brain tumor.
Oh, thanks.
Kind of unfortunate that there's another fruit that's much smaller named grape. Because, there's situations in doctor's offices, we found a tumor, it's the size of a grape. Thank God I didn't finish. Grapefruit. Oh, that's very different.
But, understandably, people are like, don't do this. You know what I mean? Come on, because there is an aftertaste to comedy. You know what I mean? It's like even if someone laughs at something.
I saw you try that when we were at Gotham. Yeah. You tried
the swallowing disorder.
The swallowing disorder. And you, I think you just, your waiter comes up to you and says something, your wife is having a problem. And you,
yeah.
And you just go.
She's fine. She has a brain tumor. It's just like you. It's just like.
And while you're eating. And yeah. You do it while you're shoveling.
This is good food. Soup. This is good soup. And it's just like as a couple, you don't want to draw attention to the fact that your wife is like, sounds like she's choking. It's just how she happens to swallow bread. But everyone in a restaurant doesn't know that. They think someone needs to do the Heimlich, and you're like, do I have to stand up to do the Heimlich? Because I don't want my soup to get cold.
Okay. So are you saying that audiences don't like that?
Well, I think it's...
It has been working, or...
I think it's been working, but I think it's awareness of how it comes across. I think some comedians love the fact that they make the audience feel uncomfortable, and I think that I don't get an enjoyment out of it necessarily, but I'm aware of it. So maybe I'm kind of I communicate with them that don't worry. I know that this is weird. You know what I mean? Because we all are in situations where someone says something and you're like, all right, they've said something that's either, sexist or insensitive. And you're like, all right, this is going to be really awkward. But if the person's like, I know that comes across as sexist, then you'll give them a pass and hopefully they'll prove that it's not.
And that's your critical interview.
Yeah, hopefully.
Doing that job. Okay, we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back with Jim Gaffigan.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
You came out and said something in the last election, which is not you. That's not what you've done. It's funny. There are some comedians, I won't say who, because they will tell me, look, I just want my comedy to speak for itself, and I don't want to take public stances.
Yeah.
And you obviously have a very broad audience.
Yeah.
I remember seeing you at the grandstand in the State Fair in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And that's a big, big grandstand and full. You filled it. And that's a lot of people.
Different views.
Different views. Of course, you're going to alienate a lot of your fans. A lot of your fans, if you say, you know, you can't reelect Trump.
Right.
And, you know, on the one hand, why should people listen to comedians?
Right.
One. And on the other hand, you have teenagers who must have been talking to you.
I mean, I always prided myself on, I'm not going to pretend that I, you know, have the most diverse audience, but I like the fact that the lesbian couple would be sitting next to the Mormon family at my shows, you know, and they'd both be laughing at the same stuff. But, you know, there was this, you know, the past summer, I guess it was the summer, you know, we had just gone through the George Floyd thing. We had just, you know, this pandemic had been going on. And there, and I've always, you know, I had a tweet that I said, like, if you're letting a celebrity tell you who to vote for, you know, you shouldn't vote. You know what I mean? It's just weird. But there came a time where I was just, I was looking at my kids and I was like, I didn't want the passage of time to occur. And my kids are like, why didn't you stand up and say something? I'm like, well, you know, I travel to a lot of smaller markets and I'm very big in some farm belt area. You know what I mean? It's like, there comes a point where it's like, there's nothing normal about someone who goes on stage and seeks approval from strangers. I'm not trying to present that, like, you know, I'm this moral leader. I like having people laugh at my jokes. But I do think that there came a point where I was like, all right, I know that people are going to be mad. And it was during, you know, the convention. And, you know, I was seeing all these lies working. And I wasn't speaking to the people that were going to vote for Trump. I was speaking to the people that were kind of where I'm from, in a small town in the Midwest. I'm from the Rust Belt, that were kind of like ethnically Catholic or whatever. And they were, you know, seeing a nun or, you know, Lou Holt say that Biden was a bad Catholic, that, you know, that I knew was a lie. And I knew that people that had common sense knew it was a lie, but I just wanted to, like, go on the record kind of like, this is obviously bullshit. And the weird thing is that I had posted stuff, you know, obviously during even like the George Floyd thing, you know, which is, I mean, hopefully that's all right to describe it as the George Floyd thing. There was like one of those things where you had to stand up for, like, you know, obviously the right thing. You know, it's like, hey, maybe, you know, maybe we should reevaluate this. And I started to get some people like, hey, you're a comedian, shut up. And then people thought I was drunk. I wasn't drunk. I was just, then I just was like, I describe it as I treat myself. Like, I don't know if that ever happens to you. It's like, someone gives you shit, you're like a nice Midwesterner, and then you're like, all right, fuck you, motherfucker. You know, like, you're going to see another side that you're going to regret that you, you assumed that I was just going to be a docile person. And so I, you know, just kind of unloaded. It's like the Lou Holtz thing. It's like I grew up like going to Notre Dame games. Lou Holtz is a child hero of mine. But the fact that he would be this pawn is just like, you know what? Fuck Lou Holtz. And that's where, like, I think it was so, it's such a fascinating thing because, again, like I said, I did it kind of so that I could look my children in the eyes, you know? But it was really interesting to see what I'm sure Sarah Silverman deals with every day. Do you know what I mean? Just this onslaught of mischaracterizations. You know, I just don't want people to just assume. Because, by the way, I come from a town that, you know, from a part of the Midwest that is Rust Belt, that, like, I can understand that they find elitists, you know, they feel condescended to. I totally get it.
Absolutely.
What I'm saying is you can hate elitists, but don't embrace Trump. That's what I wanted to say.
People have a right to resent elites because elites are self-serving.
Yeah.
You know, if you went to an Ivy League school, your kid can get into that. They help their own, right?
Yeah.
And they get SAT training and they're rich.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they get every opportunity there is. And white working class people have seen the economy such that their kids aren't going to do better than them.
Yeah.
And where elites are going to be fine. And elites, you know, I totally understand that. But Trump is such a dangerous, and it's just gotten worse, right? It hasn't gotten any better.
No. It's like you could drop this podcast at any point in the next 3 months. And I guarantee you that within the last 5 days, Trump has done something that is just like, why would he do that? Why would he, you know, like, you know, an infrastructure bill that, you know, obviously is super popular and would help constituents in this congressional district, why would he primary the people that are voting for something that, like, you know, from what I understand of politics, it's like people like it. Bridges.
Because we have terrible infrastructure. We're like 17th in the world in infrastructure. We're the, you know, and Trump, of course, was the builder. Remember, he was a builder.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I was there, every week was infrastructure week, and we never got it done. And he had the Republican majority in both houses. He never got it done. And we have shitty infrastructure in this country and really need to do this.
Yeah.
And it was insane. I mean, a lot of Republican senators voted for it because they knew that if they didn't, Democrats would just put it in the reconciliation package and Republicans wouldn't get any credit for it. But the House is nuts. And now he's going after them.
Well, he's going after the Senate.
Kevin McCarthy, though, is also like thinking of punishing them, but not Gosar, for putting out a video of him stabbing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, you can't do that in any other workplace. You can't, like, you know, Gary, did you... put out a video?
I know that you and Melinda don't get along, but did you put out a video where you're stabbing her?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I did. But, you know, but we're both fighting for that promotion, so.
She didn't like it?
Did you have the people that work for you harass her? It is strange. So, like, historically, there's obviously been Paul Gosars. Right. I mean, I saw footage of a guy who, even after Nixon resigned, he was loyal to Nixon and, thought it was a big conspiracy and all this stuff. But, like, there's no consequences. That's what also is scary, is that, like, for me as this outsider who, is fascinated by politics, you know, like, we look at people on the right, on the fringe right, and they're like, you know, Hillary's going to jail next week. You know what I mean? Like, and we're like, okay. But then on January 6th, people were like, well, once Biden gets in, there's going to be some consequences for this. Both sides is, you know, like, I feel like I've been sold a bag of goods because, I mean, do you think that it's like, they're like, well, we can't criminalize the other party because then Trump will immediately do it. But my point is Trump's going to do that anyway.
Well, yeah, if we get rid of the filibuster, well, then McConnell will do whatever he wants to do. Well, you know, they don't want to do anything. All they want to do is confirm judges, which they can do without the filibuster, and cut taxes, which they can do without the filibuster, but we discuss that a lot on this show. So I do it.
Okay.
Because one of the things about politics, and I told you about this, is that I thought Trump was a stand-up. I mean, I thought that's how he won the election.
Yeah.
When he called other people low energy, I think all he ever did was in the morning get in a limo, go out to Teterboro, get on his private jet, have a Big Mac.
Yeah.
Land, get picked up by a limo, go to a venue with 20,000 people who laughed and cheered at everything he said.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talented. He could riff.
Yeah.
None of the other candidates had any chance whatsoever.
And that's not exhausting to do compared to like talking process.
You get energy from that. You know that.
Yeah, you can't. Like last night, I did a show last night, and it's like I couldn't sleep because there's a certain amount of energy, no matter how tired you are, that's going to keep you awake. But I think that Trump, and we talked a little bit about this, Trump not only is a great comedian, he's the ultimate put-down comedian. Like that is... That's what I call it, like eighth grade. Like, and you know, like, look, people love roasts and stuff like that. It's not my thing, but like, there is an appetite for that that is fulfilling from a carnivorous viewpoint. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of blood in the water in put down humor, you know, like whether it be someone doing your mama jokes or saying little Marco, it's like, that's way more interesting than talking about how are you going to pay for...
Oh, yeah, the others in those debates.
Yeah.
You couldn't listen to the others because they would do political talk and on policy.
And so, well, you know, it's also weird because it's not to say that some of these politicians aren't funny. Like, I think Al Gore's funny. I think that Bill de Blasio is pretty engaging. But, like... The camera on Al Gore, or the even like Bob Dole, was a pretty funny guy.
He was really funny. Since this interview, Bob Dole passed, and Dole was really funny. He was the one, I think, who came up with there was three ex-presidents standing, and I think it was Carter, Clinton, and Nixon were standing. And Dole said, there's see no evil, hear no evil, and evil. He was a really great senator, and we miss him.
But, like, when the camera was on, it, you know, like, some of it is you have to play the role. But, like, Al Gore, de Blasio is a pretty charming guy. I know people are probably going to, you know, send me hate mail or whatever. But, like, I've met him a couple times. He's pretty charming. He can work a room like a good politician should. But, like, on TV, he doesn't come across like a 6'4". Engaging guy. He, you know, and that's the same with Al Gore and with Bob Dole. So like that's where Trump has a real skill. And I think some of it is the fearlessness that like I think great comedians have. Like Chris Rock has a fearlessness. I mean, I've seen him go on stage when he's just working out material and he'll like bomb for like 10 minutes. He'll be like, what else? And he's just trying things out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm kind of, you know, I need to go to my inside voice. Like me. and that's where I think Trump has that. Not only is he a put down comic, but he is also fearless.
Well, he's sick.
At his own rally, he said, I got the vaccine. People booed. And he's like, yeah. Like, you know, like most politicians would be like, oh, no, they're booing. And he's like, nah. Like he is, that's a skill. That's a skill. That's why I'm voting for Trump. No.
Well, I mean, his people will go with him on it. I mean, he can contradict himself. It's just crazy making. And it, by all logic, after January 6th, everyone should have said, okay, dodgeable, never want to see that guy again. And we're going to see him again.
What chapter was January 6th? Because obviously, grab him by the pussy was one of the chapters where it's like, no one could survive this.
Right.
No one could survive January 6th. No one could survive grab them by the... And there's probably three other ones that we're not even thinking of.
Well, the first one he did that I thought was, okay, that's it, is I like people who weren't captured. And I'm just going like, you can't do that.
Right.
This guy was shot down doing...
He was the Republican...
And also...
candidate 2 years, you know, 4 years ago.
And you go like, you... asshole,
yeah,
is all I could think of. And doesn't everyone else think that? And evidently not.
There is the, I mean, I never understood the strange bedfellows thing of politics anyway. I know that, I mean, maybe because I went to such a small high school and I'm not really a group kind of guy, but like, and I don't play golf. I don't know. Like, I always picture the people that play golf with people they don't like. I'm like, how do you do that? That's like hours of your day. And, you know, there's classic examples of Ted Cruz and even McCarthy, you know, like where you're like, you, and even McConnell, you know that Trump will throw you onto a pile of flaming rocks
that are on a subway track.
You know, in the next breath. Yet they're like hanging in because they don't want to be Adam Kinzinger, right?
Well, that's the thing, is that my former colleagues are afraid to be labeled as a never Trumper. And so they won't say the election, they will not say the election wasn't stolen. Because if they say that, Republicans in their state will go, oh, he's a never Trumper. And the only way, this will be a senator from Oklahoma or somewhere that, and the only way they could ever lose is to a Republican, and a Republican to their right, and a Republican who's a Trump Republican, and the base believes, you know, the Republican base are Trump people. So, I mean, Chuck Grassley's 87 years old, running for re-election. He said that Trump had lied about the election being stolen.
Yeah.
He just embraced him in Iowa. You know, if you're 87 years old and you aren't ready to maybe sacrifice your career on principle,
There's
probably are not going to do it.
But that's also my country club thing. It's not the country club. It's the restaurant. You want to eat a meal in peace. So if you want to eat a meal in peace in your home state, like, who was the Tennessee senator that had a thing with Trump and then he left? And
oh, Corker.
I don't know if Corker can enjoy a meal in Tennessee like he should be. Like, he was a successful guy. And I bet you, like, when he's in a restaurant, people are like, you didn't support Trump. You know, like, he can't have a meal. And so that's...
That'd be interesting. My thinking is that he's going to high-end restaurants. He's a pretty wealthy guy.
Yeah,
it was a developed shopping centers.
Yeah,
and that in those places, that's those kind of wealthier Republicans they're for Trump because of tax cuts, but they may not hate Corker for.
Yeah,
we're actually trying to game where it's like where Corker can
Corker
go to dinner.
Is like, he can go to dinner. he's like, how do you feel about going to dinner? Goes, I can go to dinner in Nashville within the 25-mile area, but there's a restaurant in Johnsonville that I want to go to that I can't.
A barbecue place that's the best. he's fine. He's fine.
Yeah,
I'm not worried about him. But he did. Yeah, he just bailed because he didn't want to hang around. I don't think he liked being senator particularly.
I thought that he was kind of positioning himself to possibly run for president. Like, so Chris Christie is obviously.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
I sat next to him on a plane when I was flying.
I hope it was first class.
Yeah, it was first class. What's so great about New Yorkers and people from New Jersey and Connecticut is they're not like impressed by anything, really. So I sat next to him and people would come up and they were generally pretty polite. They were like, you know, New Yorkers will not hesitate in saying, you know, pretty much anything. But like, and he was pretty cordial and stuff like that. And it's like he likes the game. I think he wants to be in there. Right.
Yeah. And I think
it's a long shot. It's an absolute long shot. Right.
They might as well. What else? You know, and his relationship with Trump is very strange because, you know, he got COVID at that Rose Garden super spreader event that they had when Coney Barrett was announced. Thank God he had no comorbidities.
He's like, I got all of them. But like, the strange bedfellow. So. And I didn't ask him about this, but like, so you're the first one when you bow out, you endorse Trump and people are like, what are you doing? Then you set up his transition. Then Trump
fires you because
his son-in-law.
Yeah.
And then you hang in there. I mean, that's where politics to me, I'm like, that's weird. Do you know what I mean? Like that's, you know, look, I'll kiss some ass to get a movie role, but like. I don't know if somebody screwed me over. I don't know if I could bite my tongue that much.
No. But, speaking of movie roles, I don't think I've seen you in a movie.
I only do movies that no one ever sees.
So what's the latest? Because I know you were shooting something earlier.
Oh, I'm in Peter Pan. I play Mr. Smee in a live action version of Peter Pan. Jude Law is Captain Hook and some young kids.
What is the character Mr. Smee?
Mr. Smee is Captain Hook's kind of first mate.
Oh.
And he's a dunce. I always play dumb guys.
You do that really well.
Well, it's fun. You know, you and I did a commercial. I don't know if you remember that.
No.
We did. It was just I think it was for Parquet.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember doing, that was the only commercial I've done.
Oh, really?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
And
it was, what did you play in it?
I think I played the butter.
Hey, I just wanted to jump in to the interview now and clarify something, which is Jim played a baked potato. And we'll play that in a moment.
And I remember being cast for it because I had been told that I sound like you. And I was like, all right, there's. And I was like, Parquet. And you were communicating with this thing. I wasn't on camera, but they had me there. And I would say, Parquet, butter. You know what I mean?
I'm here to see if an expert can taste the difference between butter and new Parquet. You, sir, are from?
Oregon.
I would have thought Idaho.
I get that a lot.
Well, let's just do it.
Mmm, very creamy, rich.
It's butter.
Parquet.
It tastes like butter.
Parquet.
I don't like pepper.
Yeah, but I do.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Easy. Hey. Whoa.
The richest, creamiest parquet ever.
Nothing says
butter
like new parquet.
I did a lot of commercials, and I remember having friends that would refuse to do commercials, but they would have day jobs where they worked for corporate America. I'm like, what is the difference exactly? You know what I mean? It's like you're working for the man in some form.
Well, they don't want to be seen working for the man publicly.
Yeah.
And Parquet is the man, by the way.
Parquet is it's the ultimate man. It's like anti-nature. It's anti-butter. You know, in Wisconsin, I think margarine was illegal.
In Minnesota, it was.
Yeah.
And then, but it was legal. This is, we had this stupid thing where you couldn't sell it colored.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is when I'm a kid. And so you would get it in a pouch, and there was this food coloring. It would be in a plastic clear pouch, and you would, with your thumb, break the seal on the food coloring and then squeeze it and mix it around so it would look like
butter.
Butter. But, that was because we had dairy farmers, and Wisconsin had that too. So,
yeah,
it was illegal.
It was silly.
For a while, and then you had to do the.
Then they're like, "All right, what if
you had
they
to
make
squeeze it?
They have to color it themselves."
Yeah,
If they want it to look like butter, add an extra step, even though it's healthier for people, right?
I'm not sure it is.
Probably not, right?
Probably not, actually.
Right. But at that time, they were like, this is going to save people.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they lied.
Well, because maybe they didn't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Let's not go down that because I don't know the science.
It's a conspiracy. I'm joking.
So this movie, do you have fun doing those?
I really love, I love acting.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's really, it's a different thing. I mean, stand-up is so rewarding because there's that immediate feedback.
Oh my God.
That is, you know, it's really kind of cruel when you are writing something and you don't get feedback versus stand up. You're like, is this anyone? Is this good? You know, like you write an essay and people might tweet about it. But so, yeah, the immediate feedback. But I love acting and being like a piece in a larger part of a story. And like,
well, a stand up is kind of lonely.
But you also have complete control. So I like acting because, you know, you've given up a lot of control. Like, in fact, I like not having the authority in acting and being kind of a soldier for someone else's vision. I like that. Maybe because I had my own show for a while and you work with people and you're like, I can't believe how difficult people are. So having gone through that experience, I always want to be the person that the director or the writer or the producers are like, well, at least there's Gaffigan. He's not an actor.
Well, I'd say your rep is pretty good on that score just in general.
You're hopefully.
Good guy.
Yeah.
Okay, the special is, and you shoot like one a year. Is that about right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we can talk about that because there is something about, you know, why do one a year? Because, like, if you asked me 10 years ago, I'd be like, that's stupid. Don't do one a year. How do you know you're done? And, you know, like, I'm friends with Seinfeld, and he's like, don't do that. That's dumb. But I believe that, or I've grown to believe that there is a certain life of a joke that, you know, as you know, you do a joke a couple times, it's really fun, then it kind of, like, maybe it gets stale, then you try and you learn how to perform it better, and then maybe you add an element, but then it's pretty much locked in. And so I think that the reason
you're sitting there going like, I can't believe I'm telling this joke again.
there's something about that, but there's also, there's the fear that I like. You know, that's, you know, live performance is, you know, just because it's worked a million times doesn't mean it's going to work this time. So I like the new feeling of jokes. I guess that's what.
Of course. I always feel like when I was writing at SNL and just anything new.
Yeah.
I just felt as good as my newest thing, latest writing.
Yeah. That was always like when people are like, what's your favorite joke? I'm like, whatever the newest one is.
Yeah. But you're touring, you do 300.
Yeah, I mean, I know that sounds insane, but it probably is a lot like that.
But how much is in town here at Gotham?
I would say, you know, half of that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, okay, because it sounds like a nightmare to be on the road.
Yeah, no, that's, you know. By the way, I go on the road, and it is, I mean, it's unfair to leave my wife with five kids. Like, see ya. But so, like, there is part of me that I'll typically get up with my kids in the morning and help get everyone out. But when I'm on the road is when I am in full writing mode.
And what's your writing process? I mean, how do you?
It's usually identifying something that bumps me, you know, that seems odd. Or it'll be an awkward experience like I did a show last weekend and someone, you know, got ill. So we had to stop the show and they turned on the lights and the paramedics came in and then the person was fine. And then I have to go back up and I'm just kind of like riffing on it. It's like, what is that person's conversation with the doctor? You know, they're like, well, I don't know. I was listening to Jim Gaffigan and I just felt nauseous. And the doctor's like, that'll happen. And, you know, and then there's the doctor saying anything else. And he's like, I just had this vision of just like this white blob. It was like a light, but I knew it was Jim Gaffigan. You know what I mean? So it's things like that, awkward situation. And, you know, some of the chaos of having five kids, you're exposed to a lot of awkward situations. Like, I remember one time Seinfeld said, he goes, I'm kind of jealous that you have five kids because you're exposed to so much discomfort. Uh-huh. You know, because the humor can come out of that, right?
He doesn't seem to be exposed to a lot of discomfort.
He's a total workhorse. He's like my comedy rabbi.
Remember, he did a documentary about throwing away his... got rid of his act. He did it on Broadway, right?
Yeah.
And then he started over. And I thought that was really interesting.
It's fascinating. You know, like stand-up has shifted so much during my career. Like there used to be a comedian would do maybe one special and or maybe two. Like there was the exception of Carlin and Richard Pryor, but most comedians would do their act. I mean, even going back to the Borscht Belt, people would have their act forever, right? Mm-hmm,
sure.
But there's been this shift where, you know, now Chappelle releases one every 3 months. You know what I mean? So it's, you know, it's a little bit all over the place, but there's an unspoken agreement with the audience that you're going to show up with new stuff.
Right.
They think they want the old stuff, but they want the new stuff.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
And that means you got to come up with a new act.
Yeah. And that's fun. And that's the self-assignment. And you also evolve and you can't do the same thing. It's like a friendship. You have to, those good friendships are not the people that just do the same thing. They challenge you and they evolve and they make you question things. So hopefully... I think like an audience, it's like a friendship.
Well, I can't wait to see the special.
Oh, well, thanks.
And did you do the thing about the billionaires in space?
I did that.
It made me laugh. I saw that when you did that at Gotham. Well, let's get together again.
You got it.
Time.
You got
it. Comedy Monster. The special is Comedy Monster, and it's on Netflix.
Yep.
And it premieres on the 21st of December. Right. So that's in the we're dropping this one on the 19th. So building anticipation.
Anticipation.
And how does one get Netflix? I'm sorry. What
if they're like, no, then you're like, so what is Netflix?
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fu,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.
The early 2000s was a wild time for reality TV. There seemed to be an endless supply of shows that delivered entertainment for us, but trauma for children. I'm Misha Brown, the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Each week on The Big Flop, comedians join me to chronicle the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? We recently looked behind the scenes of what was really going on at Abby Lee Miller's dance studio. Abby's biggest misstep wasn't screaming nonsensical catchphrases or throwing chairs on television, but instead, she was choreographing financial fraud in plain sight. Join me to break down all the wild details of Abby Lee Miller's story. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.